This morning at the early service, I made a statement regarding Terry Smith that I wanted to make at the second service. Perhaps those of you who are here tonight at the second service were at the second service this morning, and I just expressed my appreciation for him. I don't know whether Terry's here tonight or not, but I want him to know how much I appreciate the work that he's doing. He's been going at it at such a clip lately, I've hardly seen him. We've hardly seen each other, except just in passing to kind of throw up our hands. Not like this, but, you know, like that. Sometimes like that, but it's a real pleasure having him here, and he's doing a great work among us, and we're delighted that he and Charlotte are with us. May God bless us while we study together tonight. I invite your attention to the text that we'll not use as a text, but we will refer to it on more than one occasion tonight. But we're taking the evidence concerning the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. We're taking piece at a time, and perhaps piece at a time doesn't really make all that much sense, but I'm counting on the full picture dawning on us perhaps by next Sunday evening, and that the culmination and the accumulation of all this evidence together will be such forceful evidence that you'll be drawn and perhaps driven to the conclusion that Jesus of Nazareth is genuinely raised from the dead and that he lives today. And this is a fantastic awareness whenever one comes to it. It will shock you. It will scare you. It will amaze you. It will encourage you. It will strengthen you. It will cause you to be worshipful. It will set you in awe. And I pray that we might enjoy that full assurance of his resurrection and enjoy the power that comes from Christ being in us, which is the hope of glory. Last Sunday night, we studied two bits of evidence concerning the resurrection of Jesus. Strangely enough, they weren't considered as evidence, especially the first one, the empty tomb. They didn't look at it as evidence of the resurrection. They didn't know what it was. They weren't trying to prove the resurrection. They had no idea that he was going to be raised. So when they saw the empty tomb, all it did to them was confuse them. When the news came to the chief priests and all, the empty tomb caused them to not question the fact that it was empty. They knew it was empty. The soldiers had reported what had happened, and they knew the tomb was empty. So did the disciples know it. It had been reported empty by Mary and the other women. It had been reported empty by John and Peter. They knew it was empty. The question of the empty tomb never was raised to the early people of the first century. The only question that ever came up was, why was it empty, and what were the implications of it being empty? This is significant to me. It's one of those subtle things that kind of lies there, and all of a sudden it jumps out at you. You know, no one ever questioned the empty grave. No one ever questioned it. There's nothing in any secular writing. There's nothing in the full sacred writings here in the four Gospels that ever questioned the emptiness of the tomb. It was taken for granted. And people started accusing each other. Mary started accusing the people. Who the they is, I don't know. But she came and reported to Peter and John and the other disciples, they have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and well, we don't know where they've laid him. Well, they evidently were she thought, perhaps the enemies or someone else. She didn't know. She was just making accusations. The enemies of Jesus accused the disciples of Jesus and accused them of having come while the soldiers were asleep and having stolen away the body. Well, here were these cross accusations being leveled, the disciples against the Jews and the Jews against the disciples. But you know, in the fire and in the crossfire, one fact still remains true. The body was gone. And that slaps me right in the face and says, wake up, something's happening here. The body was gone. And no one questioned it. And not only was the empty tomb empty, or the tomb empty, but also there was no other evidence at the time to indicate what would be the solution to this riddle. The riddle was simply, the tomb is empty. How do you explain it? And here the explanations began to come in, but none of them were true. And then finally, and not until Peter and John happened to see the grave cloths and the message that these silent grave cloths transmitted to the disciples, at least to John, the message was, very conclusive. Jesus must have been raised from the dead. Peter and John both came to the grave that morning early upon the report by Mary, a false report, that someone had taken the body of Jesus away. They ran to the tomb with that preconceived misconception and got there and were dumbfounded as they saw the grave being empty. But when Peter and John, or when John saw the grave cloths, the message that he received from those cloths, evidently the way they were lying and the way that the headband was lying, as though the body had just simply taken leave and had left the grave cloths lying there, this evidence drove John to the conclusion that Jesus must have been raised from the dead. Now, this was purely a conclusion that had been drawn from or by deduction. He reasoned it out. He went there with one preconceived idea. It was false. And what the grave cloths did for John was to tell him, no, the report that Mary gave you is not a true report. That which the grave cloth said to John was, well, he must have been raised from the dead. Dead bodies only move on two different ways. They either remove by someone removing it, or they remove themselves. Now, in history, there's never been known of any dead body to have moved itself. Either it was stolen or removed by someone else for a legitimate reason, or else, in this case, the possibility is that it removed itself. So we find with this open grave that was what you might call circumstantial evidence. There was not much evidence there. All it did was produce confusion. It could have meant any number of things. It could very well have been that someone stole it. It could very well have been that some friend came and moved it. It could very well have been that Joseph of Arimathea, that he became ashamed of what he had done and, realizing the social pressure, took it and put it somewhere else. The open grave was no evidence really at all of the resurrected Christ. It was merely one of those peripheral evidences. It was one of the evidences that finally, in the final analysis, had to be answered. But the point is that the grave, as it being open and empty, was not really proof of the resurrected Christ. Not until they came to the grave cloths was there any other evidence other than the tomb being empty to drive the disciples to the conclusion that something very unusual must have happened here. And upon seeing these grave cloths, John came to the conclusion that Jesus was raised from the dead. But this faith that John had here, as I say, was a faith that came by deductive reasoning. And it was completely and totally unsubstantiated. It was uncorroborated. It was a conclusion that John drew from what evidence that he had at hand. He went home believing that Jesus was raised from the dead, but having no evidence other than that to substantiate it. The only thing that stared them in the face was the grave is empty. That was a known fact, not questioned by friend or foe. Then the grave clothes lying there, plus the empty tomb, John came to the conclusion that Jesus must have been raised from the dead. This was the first indication that any of his disciples became aware of this very earth-shaking and very unusual it was a very unprecedented event in the lives and in the history of human beings. But is there any other evidence? Was there any further evidence that corroborated John's conclusion? John didn't get this through the scriptures. It said at that time it was unknown to them that Jesus Christ was to be raised from the dead. At least they were not aware of the scriptures that proclaimed this. So John had simply deducted from the empty tomb and the grave cloths that Jesus was raised from the dead. Tonight, I want to notice with you the substantiating and corroborating evidence that drove them to the conclusion, and not just drove them to the conclusion, it forced them to the reality of the resurrected Christ, and it does the same for me, and I hope that it'll do the same for you today. The further evidence that we talk about as corroborating the resurrection supposition by John is the occasion of the resurrection appearances. There were some 12 of these resurrection appearances, 7 of them in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, 5 more of them recorded in the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians, verses 5 through 8. The 7 in John in the Gospels, we'll notice in just a moment, we want to spend our time there tonight, but the 5 that are mentioned in 1 Corinthians 15 are those 5, and one of them is very important because there were 500 people together at one time that saw the resurrected Christ. And most of them were alive at the time that Paul wrote this to the Corinthian church. So he's putting himself out on a limb. Here was some evidence being presented that could have been stricken down in 2 seconds had any of these people of the 500 said, well, wait a minute, I didn't see that. That was an illusion. I didn't really mean it. I don't believe that at all. But it was important here, and it was recorded in 1 Corinthians 15, because there were so many people who saw it at one time. Another one of those resurrection appearances that is referred to in 1 Corinthians 15 is the resurrection appearance that Jesus Christ made to the Apostle Paul. This is important for many reasons, but for one reason, because of the amount of space that it occupies in the book of Acts. The account itself, the event, is recorded in Acts, the 9th chapter. It's retold again in Acts, or it is retold in Acts 22, and then retold again in Acts, the 26th chapter. So you have three different occasions where the resurrection is, the appearance is recorded as actually having happened, and then being told in Acts 22 and retold in Acts 26. So you have quite an amount of space given to the resurrection appearance that took place between Jesus of Nazareth and this man Saul of Tarsus. And we'll mention him more perhaps later in other lessons. But the ones that I want to mention to you tonight are the ones that are recorded in the Gospels. And there were seven of these. And these initial seven appearances involve a very few people. There were Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Salome and Joanna. And then there was Cleopas and a companion of his who lived in Emmaus. And then there was Simon Peter. And then the ten who are called in Acts in 1 Corinthians 15, they're called the 12, referring to them as a body of men known as the 12, but there were only 10 of them present. Judas was dead and Thomas was absent on that first Sunday evening when Jesus appeared to them. And then on the next Sunday morning, on Sunday evening, Thomas was with the other 10. There were 11 of them then present. And Jesus appeared to them again and called for Thomas to see the evidence before him. And then a few days later, perhaps that same week, the seven of the men, Peter and Andrew and John and four others, were there on the Sea of Galilee fishing, and there was another appearance. But these in all included only about 18 to 20 men and women, just about that small a number. And these appearances, of course, were very, very important. And we want to notice them tonight. The question arises, it arose then. It arises today. It always has arisen. That which must be answered, and I think it is a legitimate question, is simply this. How do you know, this would be asked them, how do you know that the one that you saw was Jesus of Nazareth? How do you know that? And I think we have the right, I think any skeptic has the right to ask these men who claim to have seen Jesus Christ, we have the right to ask them, how do you know that the one you saw was Jesus Christ? What evidence do you have? They asked themselves the same question. They thought at times they saw a ghost. At other times they were not quite sure what they saw. But nevertheless, they asked themselves the question, is this one that we believe we're seeing, is he really this Jesus from Nazareth? And I have the right to ask them, is he the Jesus of Nazareth? I want to know whether the one you saw was Jesus of Nazareth. I have a right to know. And I want to know if there's any evidence that substantiates what they claim to have seen. Even skeptics admit from the subsequent history of these Christian people, skeptics even admit that these people saw something, or at least they thought they saw something. And what I want to know is, what did they see? Is it evidence, or is it evidential, or can it be proved? Is there substantial evidence to prove that this one that they saw, or that they thought they saw, was Jesus of Nazareth? And the question simply comes down to I want to phrase it in a figure. Are there any threads of certainty that we can draw from the life of Christ that continue through his death? Are there any threads of certainty that go through his death, through the burial tomb, that come out on the other side of the tomb that we can lay hold on and say, yes, this is reality, this is certainty, and I have a hold of these things that convince me that Jesus of Nazareth, the one they claim to have seen after the death seen and after this empty tomb seen, the one that they saw was actually the one that they had known as Jesus of Nazareth. I want to know tonight, are there any such threads of certainty? This tapestry that they were watching being woven for 3 years, you see, in the life of Jesus, this beautiful tapestry, suddenly with an abrupt stop, with an abrupt ending, ended in disgrace and shame. This man was put to death like a common criminal, and all of their dreams and their hopes and aspirations ended when this man was suddenly put to death. Then the empty tomb confronted them. They were thrown again for another loss. They couldn't explain that. Now I'm asking, are there any threads that come out of that tomb by which we can come to some assurance that the one that they saw or even thought that they saw was really Jesus of Nazareth? And I'll answer this question about what they thought they saw, and I don't want to forget it. I'll answer it at the end of the service. because it is very vital, I think, and a very simple question that I'd like to answer for you. But the answer to this question, is there any evidence that is genuine enough that we can find, that we can sense, yes, this man was really the same Jesus that was put to death, the same Jesus that they knew prior and during his personal ministry? The appearances that we're going to notice tonight have three characteristics that cause us to know that Jesus of Nazareth was really raised from the dead. They make me know that. And I stand here tonight with a conviction that Jesus of Nazareth was raised from the dead, that he's coming one day, and personally, the sooner the better. If it were to come tonight, it would tickle me to death, except that I know there are people who are lost that need Christ and would be lost and would go to hell were he to come tonight. But as far as I'm concerned, I believe that Jesus of Nazareth was raised literally from the dead, that we stand right now in a new age, that the new eternal age has overlapped our age, and we are now standing in the resurrection age. We're living there. I believe that I, as a follower of Jesus Christ, have been given eternal life. I don't believe I'll ever die. Physically, yes, but I'll never die spiritually. I believe he has given me eternal life, and one day I'll have it eternally without any possibility of having it taken away. But there are three things, three characteristics of these resurrection appearances that I want you to notice. One of them by which they could know that Jesus was really and truly alive was that these people recognized his body. They recognized his physical body. Now, Jesus pressed this aspect on at least two different occasions. One in Luke 24th chapter, as we were reading on past where we read tonight as the text, he appeared to them after these men, Cleopas and his friend, came back to Jerusalem, went into the upper room, burst in, and were about to tell about the resurrection of seeing the Lord. But before they could get it out of their mouth, the 10 or 11 that were gathered there said, Jesus has risen, the Lord indeed has risen, and he has appeared to Simon. And then they told the things that they had experienced on the road to Emmaus, how that he had been known to them in the breaking of the bread. And then while they were talking, Jesus appeared in the midst of them, scared them to death, and said, peace be unto you. And then he said, why are you so questioning? Why do doubts arise in your mind? And then he said, come and feel of me. Touch my hands, my feet. Look, it is I. A spirit doesn't have flesh and bones like you see me having. And then he asked, do you have anything to eat? And they gave him a piece of honeycomb and some fish, and he stood there and ate in front of them. But they recognized his body, and he pressed the issue. He said, I want you to know my body. I want you to feel of me. It was very important. Again, in John the 20th chapter, on the second Sunday evening, not the first Sunday evening of his resurrection, but 8 days later, he was there and appeared again in the midst. Thomas had missed the first Sunday evening service. You know, Thomas, there's a lot about Thomas that reminds me of a lot of Christians. He missed a service, and you know, you never can tell what's going to happen at a service of Christian people. And Thomas missed a service. And sure enough, something very unusual happened. The Lord came. And you know what? The Lord Jesus Christ might just come on some Sunday evening service, and you may have missed it if you weren't here. But you never can tell what'll happen where Christian people are gathered together. Something good is always happening. But nevertheless, on this second Sunday evening, Thomas was there, and Jesus said to him, Thomas, come here. And Thomas knew he was in for it. He had already seen it. Now, he had said, I'll never believe it unless I put my finger into his nail prints of his hands and put my hand into his side. I'm not going to believe it. Well, when Jesus appeared that second time, he said, Thomas, come here. And he said, put your hand now in my hand and put your hand in my side, and don't be unbelieving. Thomas, he said, you believe. And Thomas fell down and said, my Lord and my God. Thomas recognized his body. He recognized his hands. He recognized his side. Jesus Christ appeared to him in a physical form and said to him, look, believe on me. It's I. A spirit doesn't have flesh and bones. Look at me, feel of me. And this kind of a verification of the identification of Jesus was very vital and essential to the message that these men were going to proclaim. They weren't out preaching some kind of a philosophy that was based upon an insignificant philosopher. They were out proclaiming an unprecedented event in history that so shook the first century world that the world has never been the same since. That's why it was necessary that these men have some absolute concrete evidence. There was no room for these men supposing or surmising that it was the Lord. Jesus Christ saw to it that these men could go out and, like John the Apostle, some 60 years later, in his first letter that he wrote, he says, that which was from the beginning, that which we saw, that which we heard, that which our hands handled. He said, I touched him. And John, 60 years after the event, says, I myself touched him myself. Whether he meant prior to or subsequent to his crucifixion and resurrection, I don't know. But I think when Jesus Christ said, come and touch me, I think every last one of them went up there and touched him. I think that's what he was asking them to do. I think that's what he wanted them to do. He invited them to do that because the issue was at stake. And the issue that was at stake was this resurrection. And it was vital that these men knew whereof they were talking. So I say they recognized him because they recognized his physical body. But on other occasions, they didn't recognize him. On one occasion, as you remember, when Mary was at the tomb and she was crying, she was sobbing uncontrollably. She was hysterical, I think. She had jumped to a conclusion already that they had taken her Lord away and she didn't know where they had laid him. That was a false conclusion. The woman was hysterical. She turned and saw this man and she thought he was the gardener. But her eyes were filled with tears. She couldn't see clearly, perhaps, and maybe that's why she couldn't see him. But being in the state that she was, this emotional state, she looked and she was so overwrought with the sorrow, she said, sir, if you've taken him somewhere, let me know where it is and I'll go move him. Well, she didn't recognize him. Perhaps it was because of her inability to be cognizant or to be really rational at the moment, or perhaps he was in a form that she did not recognize immediately. But there's another occasion, and that was Cleopas, the one read tonight. Cleopas and his companion from Emmaus, a little city about 7 miles north of Jerusalem. They didn't recognize Jesus either. It says their eyes were kept from recognizing him. Well, he went along with them a good ways, was with them for 45 minutes or so as they walked this 7 miles, and they were there talking with him and conversing with him, and he asked them, well, what are you talking about? And they told him, and back and forth went the conversation, and when he said, what are you talking about? What things have been happening? And they said, are you the only man that's been visiting in Jerusalem and doesn't know the things that have been happening? And he said, well, what things? They said about Jesus of Nazareth, the man, the prophet mighty before God in deed and word. And they looked at him and they thought, well, you're the oddest character. Where have you been? And he went along with it, you know, and then he began to say to them, oh, foolish men and slow of heart to believe in all that the prophet said must come to pass. And he began to teach them. They went on, and as they were going on their way, he began and kept talking, and then he played like he was going on, but they didn't recognize him is the point I'm making. We'll notice something in a moment when they did recognize him. But then the seven on the fishing trip, they didn't recognize him either. He was over on the bank, about 100 yards on the bank. They were 100 yards out into the water, and they didn't recognize him. They couldn't have recognized him from distance, if for no other reason. But at that time of the morning, it says that day was just barely breaking. It was just at the break of day. Well, just at the break of day on the Sea of Galilee is misty, and it always is very misty and humid, and they couldn't have recognized him anyway. So there were three occasions where, though on some occasions they did recognize him and were asked to feel of his hands and his feet and his side, on these three occasions they did not recognize him. And for what particular reasons, I don't know. But I'm just simply saying that they didn't recognize him. Now, I want to make two observations in view of these two very obvious facts. One, the occasions on which he appeared in recognizable form clinched the issue for those who had known him physically prior to and during his death. It sealed the issue. It settled the issue. There was no more issue involved. They saw it with their own eyes. It proved to be undeniable proof to those people who had known Jesus Christ prior to his death and during his death as they saw him on the cross. They saw the same body standing there as they had known prior to his death and as they had seen hanging upon the cross. So it was very vital evidence for those people. But I didn't see him. It's not really that great evidence for me because I didn't know Jesus physically before he died. I didn't see him hanging on the cross. There was nothing in my own understanding, in my knowledge of Christ, there is nothing really except just the evidence, the bare evidence that there were wounds in his hands, feet, and side. But these men had a knowledge of him that far surpasses my knowledge of it. They had a visible knowledge of him that they said, oh, that is the Lord. I recognize his body. All right. Jesus makes a differentiation between this kind of evidence. When Thomas came in the second Sunday night and he said, my Lord and my God, Jesus then said to him, Thomas, do you believe because you've seen? Blessed are those people who, though they have not seen, still believe. And he talked about you and me. And he talked about a different kind of evidence. And he said, Thomas, you believe because you have seen something in my body that physically calls to your mind that which you knew prior to my death and during my death. And now you see me standing before you and you believe. Good on you, Thomas. But blessed are those rather who have not seen me and still believe. All right, that brings us to the second observation I want to make. Those other occasions during which Jesus Christ appeared to his disciples and his friends where they did not recognize him, what was there about him that caused them to know that it was the Lord? Now, something caused them to know that it was the Lord, even though they didn't recognize him physically. What was it? I maintain that there was other evidence, and that this evidence served those people as substantiating evidence, and it serves you and me today as substantiating and corroborative evidence that makes me know, and you'll have to speak for yourself, but I know from this other evidence that Jesus of Nazareth has been raised from the dead. And I want to talk to you about it tonight. These last two things are the other two kinds of evidence that we have in the scriptures about this occasion of the resurrection of Christ. The number one reason why they believed back there was, first of all, they recognized the body of Jesus Christ, and it was undeniable evidence. But some of those evidences were not so recognizable as far as physical attributes were concerned, and there's something in there that made them know that Jesus Christ was really and truly alive, and that what they were seeing or were thinking that they were seeing was actually that which was a carryover or was the resurrected body of this one that they had known prior. Now notice, if you will, what was that other evidence? It was this. They recognized Jesus, I think, in familiar actions. They recognized him because they recognized in him these familiar actions. In John 21, John and Peter and these other men were out in the boat fishing. And this stranger came up, and I don't know whether they even knew he was there until he spoke. And they said, "Have you caught any fish?" And they said, "No, we haven't." And he said, "Well, throw your net on the other side, the right side of the boat, and you'll catch some." And sure enough, they threw it over there. Still, the penny hadn't dropped, you know, and they threw it over there. And when John got a hold of that 153 fish and found out that the net wouldn't budge, then the penny dropped for John, and he said, "That's the Lord." Well, now why? Well, he couldn't see the Lord from where he was. He couldn't see him physically, but he knew something. Something made him surmise, "That's the Lord." You know what it was? There had been other occasions when Jesus Christ told them to put their net in somewhere and they got a load of fish that they couldn't even bring in. On one occasion, the net began to break and they finally got him in the boat and the boats began to sink. And the occasion was so similar to this one that whenever all this added together and here this stranger was standing over there saying, "Throw your net on the other side of the boat and you'll catch some fish." When they did that, John said, "That's the Lord." Peter didn't even know. He didn't catch it. You know, Peter was a bit dense in a lot of respects, and yet he had some insights also that were above and beyond the others. But John was ahead of him as far as being perceptive. John just was more reserved in the way that he expressed it. Peter was always the one, you know, to blurt it out if he'd seen something. And so we find here one occasion when they recognized something that was familiar, and they said, "It's the Lord." On another occasion that we read about tonight, whenever the two disciples, Cleopas and his friend, were on the way to Emmaus, and they were there talking with him for 45 minutes and all. And they finally came to their house. And Jesus played like he was going to go on. And he was hoping they would ask him in. And sure enough, they did. And they said, "Why don't you come on in and stay? It's getting toward evening and the day is far spent." And so he went in with them and sat down at table. And he took this bread and broke it and gave thanks. And it says that then their eyes were opened and they recognized who he was. And he vanished out of their sight. Well, now, what was it in the breaking of bread that made these men realize who it was? It may have been that he caused it, that he opened their eyes. I don't know, but something about it caused them to know it. And they recorded it again later on when they went back to Jerusalem and told where it was that they recognized him. They said it was in the breaking of the bread. Well, what was there about the breaking of the bread that was so significant? I think, frankly, it was this. I think these men had seen him break bread and give thanks so many times that they recognized it as a familiar characteristic of the Lord Jesus Christ. And here this stranger was, who back on the road had been talking to them about all these things, and then here he breaks the bread and gives thanks, and then all of a sudden it dawns on them, "That's the Lord," and then he vanished. You know, that's not unheard of, to recognize someone familiar because of some action or some familiarity. When I was a boy of 6 years old, my first year of school was a very unfortunate year. It set me off on a kind of a... I never did really get to like school, I guess. And I, all the way back to the first grade, I kind of had a... I don't know, I just didn't like it much. And I wanted to go home. I wanted to be with my mama and my daddy and my sisters, I guess. I just didn't have much use for the first grade anyway. The old floors smell like oil and all that, you know, these old schools. And I just didn't like it. One day I was sitting there on the front row, and I remembered as well as it were yesterday, the school where I was sitting was two blocks from the town square. And I was sitting there pouting, I guess, on the front row, wanting to go home, and I looked through the window, and I saw a figure walking two blocks, and that was more than 200 yards, and I saw this figure walking across the square. I couldn't see his face. I couldn't see anything about him, but I just noticed a familiar gait, a familiar stride, and I knew that that was my daddy. And I just lit a shuck out of there, and she said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to my daddy," and I took off. Well, I didn't see his face, but I didn't have to see his face. I knew who he was by the way he walked. There wasn't anybody else in the world that walked like my daddy. There still isn't anybody who walks like him. I know him the way he walks. I think they knew Jesus Christ by these familiar attributes and these familiar actions of his. Well, the third thing, first of all, they recognized his body. But secondly, on those occasions when they did not or could not recognize his body, they saw these familiar qualities about him that they had known for these 3 years, and they knew full well that it was the Lord. And then thirdly, they recognized Jesus from his words, just simply from the way he talked. The simplest one of these examples is in John the 20th chapter, when Mary had seen the Lord, and she didn't know it was the Lord. She thought it was the gardener. And she was talking, and he couldn't get a word in edgewise, it seemed like. And she turned and started talking and said, "Look, if you've taken him away, show me where you've put him," and all. And she went into all this spiel, and he just finally said, "Mary." And she wheeled around, and she said, "Rabboni," which means teacher. And she rushed for him. I think she was going to lay one on him. She was rushing for him. It finally dawned on her. She'd been so overwhelmed by the death. She'd been so stunned by his disappearance, she didn't know where he was. And then she saw him standing there, alive and well. I think she literally was going to grab him. And she may have, I don't know. But Jesus said, "Don't hold me." Which may have meant, "Don't start holding me." And it may have meant, "Quit holding me." But anyway, he said, "Don't hold me. I have not yet ascended to my Father." And I don't doubt but what this woman, to whom Jesus had meant so very much, and whenever the final resolution of all this mystery came about to where she realized that he was actually alive, I don't think that she could restrain herself from expressing herself in this emotional way. And she lunged for him, and he restrained her and said, "Don't hold me." But it was just because of the word, the inflection of his voice. One word was what conveyed the identity, Mary. Can that be done? Yes, it can be done. Last week I was playing tennis early in the morning, about daybreak, with Kenneth Davis and a bunch of those men. And we were there playing tennis, and here came this hooded figure. It was cold. Here came this hooded figure walking out across the campus. I didn't know who it was until he said, "Hello, preacher." Then I knew who it was. I still couldn't see his face. I couldn't recognize his coat. I didn't know anything about him except one simple familiar thing. It was Derek Pfeiffer, and that's the way he always talks to me. He always says, "Hello, preacher." And I said, "Derek, I know that's you. I can't see your face, but I know that's you." He said, "Yeah," and he went on his way. Well, I recognized him by the simple inflection of his voice and this familiar word that he said to me. I knew it was Derek. And I never did see his face, and he went on off, but I knew that's who it was. I think that's something of what happened here when Mary saw or heard Jesus say, "Mary." But on another occasion, when these men were going to Emmaus, and we find them there after he had revealed himself to them and after he had disappeared out of their midst, they turned to each other and they said, "Did not our hearts burn within us as he taught us on the way or on the road, as he revealed to us and opened to us the scriptures? Didn't our hearts burn within us even while they were on the road?" There was something in what he taught them that was familiar enough that it got their hearts to thinking, and it set them in such an uproar that their hearts, they just said, they burned in us. They couldn't quite fathom it. But later on, the penny did drop. They understood that's who it was because of the familiarity of what he taught them. What was he teaching them? The same thing that he later on said, "This is what I taught you while I was still with you. How that the Christ must suffer and rise again the third day, and that repentance and remission of sins should be preached in his name among all the nations. This is what I taught you." And he began to open their minds so that they might receive the scriptures. These things were familiar to them. When you look back at Matthew, the 4th chapter, and find him teaching and preaching about the kingdom of God, and then turn to Matthew 13 and see how it's filled with "the kingdom of heaven is like this, the kingdom of heaven is like that." And then in Acts, the 1st chapter, in verse 3, he's still talking about the kingdom of heaven. But that was after his resurrection and death, or his death and resurrection. The other was before his death and resurrection. That's right. But you find him saying the same thing after his resurrection as you did before. That means something to me. I think it should to you also. I peg it as being, yes, that's the same man that was living back here. He's living still. Same one. You can just go throughout the New Testament, throughout the Gospels, throughout the life of Jesus, and you're going to get this fantastic, amazing conclusion. You're going to draw it. You know, he is the same one. He's the same one that was alive before and that we knew about in the Gospels. So you see, in all of this, I think I see the personality of Jesus shining through bright and clear. I didn't know him physically. I didn't know him before he was crucified. I didn't see him on the cross. So I can't make that identification as they could. But I'll tell you what I can do. I can go back and trace his teachings beforehand and after. And I can trace the things that he did, his personality. I know what he was before he was killed. I know him just as well as I know anybody before he was killed. And after he was resurrected, if that was he, or if they saw something, I know they must have seen the same one that lived before and that was called Jesus of Nazareth. It's the same man. I see the same personality shining through. His same care for people's feelings. His same calling of men. He was always calling men to follow him. It's the same man. You get this same impression all through these bits of evidence. His overriding concern for people. His willingness to humble himself to teach in a way that they couldn't misunderstand. As he washed their feet one night before he died. And then this appearance where he stood before them and said, "Look, it's I. Come in, handle me. Feel of me." And then when they still didn't believe him, he said, "Do you have anything to eat?" And he humbled himself and subjected himself to the most scrutinizing investigation so that they could know that he was really and truly Jesus of Nazareth. These evidences all add up to me to mean that this one that they saw was truly Jesus of Nazareth. But somebody said, "But you know, maybe they just thought they saw something. Maybe they just saw an apparition." No, he said, ghosts don't have skin and bones. But somebody said, "Maybe they just really saw that and he wasn't really raised from the dead." Well, that's a possibility. But then you're driven back to the same evidence. Well, how do you explain the empty tomb then? You see, that thing still shouts. The empty tomb is still there. How do you explain it? If it was just an apparition, or if it was just something that was the figment of their imagination, or if it was just some kind of a spiritual apparition that they saw and not really the physical resurrection, then the evidence or the burden of proof is on you. How do you explain the empty tomb? Well, I don't know. But you see, if he was raised from the dead then, all right, do you have any evidence that if he was raised from the dead, that this one was the one that you knew of as Jesus of Nazareth? Yes, I do. They could see by the body. Yes, they saw his body. But when I see the similarity or the identity or the identicalness, if there's such a word, when I see the exact identical nature of the way that he was before he was crucified and the way he was after he was resurrected, he's the same man. Same personality, same everything. Yes, I know. And I may not be able to prove it to you, but I believe that Jesus of Nazareth was genuinely raised from the dead and that we're living in this new age and that one day he's coming again, that he's here with us tonight, and that we live by his power and under his supervision, and we can live within him, and him being in us, or he being in us, is the hope of our glory. And I believe that we're seeing that. I believe that's the Christian age. What do you believe about the resurrection? These evidences keep coming to us. Next Sunday night, we're going to conclude the study of the resurrection as we are forced to make some kind of a conclusion as an explanation for the existence of you people. You're here for some reason or other. And you date back for 2,000 years. The question that forces us to conclude something happened back there is the existence of the church. It demands that you make some kind of a conclusion, or come to some kind of a conclusion. They saw something. I believe it was Jesus of Nazareth. I believe the evidence demands that we conclude that. Tonight, your faith may be such that you want to obey the Lord. If he's the Son of God, and if he's been raised from the dead, he asks you that you respond in one simple way. There's not but one biblical response that he asks that you make. He asked that you come in faith and bury an old man of sin in water and be raised in the same kind of a resurrection that he was raised by. And that is, he asked that you come in repentance and that you join yourself to him in baptism. There is no other biblical response. There is no other way that you can identify yourself with Jesus Christ except by being baptized into him upon the confession of your faith. That's the biblical response. And if you have sufficient faith that you say, yes, I believe that he was raised, and I want to have a part with him, I want to be with him wherever he is, and I'm ready to go. If that be your case, then your opportunity is now. And you come while we stand and sing, and we'll assist you.